The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Welcome to The Disciplined Investor. This is Andrew Horowitz, and it's episode number 52. And it is the middle of April, and it is that horrible time called tax time. And what can I say but, oh, yuck. It is one of those times that you kind of want to just reflect a little bit about, oh, why did I have to pay so much in taxes and what am I getting for it? But you know what you're getting for it? You're getting a big fat bailout. Thank you very much. Thank you very much for providing all sorts of money to Bear. Who knows next? WAMU, Wachovia. See that news today in Wachovia? Wow, that was quite ugly. But nonetheless, we have all sorts of things happening today that I think is going to be really neat. We got Zach Scheidt coming up with the Zach Zone, and he's got all sorts of great IPO ideas, as well as a short on a stock that you may not have thought about is a real good idea for a short. And we also have a special guest. I've been wanting to get him on board for a while. His name is Professor Robert Reich, the former labor secretary under the Clinton, a wonderful writer, wrote the book Super Capitalism. And we're going to talk with him about what's going on with kind of, you know, what's going on these days with the American outlook, with our economy, with the spending of money, and kind of where we're going. You know, he writes on his blog, a great blog, we'll put that in the show notes, that we may be heading into a depression. We're going to talk about that a little bit, and we have some questions for him. And, you know, besides that, I think that the best thing to talk about right now is that we have been seeing some some historic and rather disconcerting announcements in the news over the last number of weeks, and they keep on piling up. They keep on coming at us. You know, I've been on the bandwagon for shorting Capital One for some time. Well, guess what, gang? This week, we're going to find out if I am worth anything about what I say or if I'm just, you know, full of crap, because on April 17th, earnings are coming out. Now, I will tell you that there's a lot of built-up anxiety in this area, and the fact is that we are profitable on our short position, and hopefully you took advantage of that when it was in its low to mid-50s, and it's currently trading, I don't know, somewhere in the $47 range or so, depending on when you're actually listening to this. But nonetheless, you know, if you look at the latest 8K, and this is what I'm encouraging you to do, when I talk about this in my book and the chapter about fundamental investing, and I talk about understanding balance sheet items and give you an explanation of, you know, how do you look at a balance sheet? Why should you look at a balance sheet? And to give you some ideas on what to look for, not the whole thing. You don't need to really kind of become an expert forensic accountant here. But what I want you to do is just get an understanding and knowledge of it. So when you look at their 8K that came out and you see that there is a write-off in about $258 million for the month of March. And then another item that talks about a write-off in the area of another $250 million or so that's just called an adjustment. And when reporters and journalists and analysts are reporting a $250 million loss, and why did some do that? And why did some write a $500 million loss? Well, because they don't know, I guess. It's clearly a $500 million write-off. And, you know, I think that it's really important to understand what is meant by securitization, what is meant by off-balance sheet, why are these companies doing it? I thought we promised that we wouldn't leverage so much, but nonetheless, they do. I write about this in what I call Frankenstein Finance, a new phrase I coined. I had this kind of thought. I said, you know, we got all these write-offs going on, but we have all these cash infusions into these companies that could be really, dying. And it struck me. I said, wait a minute, Frankenstein Finance. Frankenstein, that's the process of trying to reanimate a company that's almost dead through cash infusion. That's what seems to be going on right now. We saw that with Washington Mutual this week. We saw that with Wachovia. We saw that with Countrywide. We saw that with just a whole slew of the banking industry. Some worked and some haven't. Bear Stearns and Lehman and, you know, I wonder, is there a smoke screen here, folks? Or is it, you know, is it something that's really happening? I don't know. I write about that as a new announcement for AOL Finance on their blogging stocks. I've been asked to write for them, and I'm writing about that. You'll see an article there, and I'll point a link to it as well. So take a look at that stuff that I've been writing. And also, I want to let you know that I was on another really cool show. Remember last week we had Jordan Goodman, who wrote the Fast Profits in Hard Times. I got a lot of great response from that. Thank you so much. A really cool book, and I encourage you to check it out. But I was on his show. We kind of get one, I guess, tit for tat. I did his, he does mine. And it's appearing now on Air America. We'll also give you a link to that on the website. And the other thing that I want to mention to you is that if you have any ideas for shows and you want to, you know, ask me some questions, of course, just send it off to askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. And, you know, I'll do my best to get the guests. If you know of somebody that could be a great guest, hey, I'm always looking for somebody who can, you know, help out with that as well. You know, overall, though, I will tell you that if you've been paying attention, you know, we're not in good shape right now. Hopefully you're in a good amount of cash, and I'm going to try over the next couple of weeks to put some fundamentals and some investment tactics down on the blog. So pay attention to that. Make sure you go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com. That's where all this is, and make sure to leave us comments if you want. And that's what I'm trying to create, this community. So please, please, please go over and lay down some comments. Go over and buy the book. We hit the top. I was number 12. The book hit number 12, gang. You guys are awesome. You guys are great. Thank you so much. We're hitting the top list on Amazon. I think we hit number 12 in under financial planning and number 15 under introduction to investments. And I think we're, I don't know, a couple thousand overall top. And I'm so pleased that you're enjoying it. And thank you so much. We get back. We're going to kick it off with our interview with Professor Reich, talk about super capitalism. I can't wait. He's a really cool guy, and I think you're really going to enjoy it. So thanks a lot for joining me. We'll be right back on the Disciplined Investor Podcast, episode number 52. Stick around. We'll be right back.
Stick around for more of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
Hi, I'm John C. Dvorak, and I listen to Andrew Horowitz's The Disciplined Investor. I think it's the best podcast on the air.
Looking for answers to today's complex financial markets? Then be sure to get your copy of The Disciplined Investor, Essential Strategies for Success, your all-in-one guide to investing. Order now at thedisciplinedinvestor.com or your favorite bookstore. The Disciplined Investor. Together, we will reach success.
All right, we're back with a special guest today. I promised you a wonderful opportunity to hear something quite special. This is Robert Reich. Professor Reich is a professor of public policy at the Goldman School of Public Policy at the University of California at Berkeley. And, of course, he served in the under three national administrations, most recently as Secretary of Labor under President Clinton. So I'm very pleased that you're joining me today and giving us some of your wisdom. Thanks for coming aboard.
Well, I'm delighted.
So you have a new book. It's called Super Capitalism, just one of 11. I just finished a book, and it was like giving birth. I can't imagine 11 books. That's quite an amazing, just on its own, it's amazing.
Well, if you're old enough, you can do as many books as you can imagine.
I suppose. So explain to everybody, what is super capitalism, and what is the whole, you know, thesis behind what you had written?
I define it as super competitive capitalism, in which every company, every corporation, is in far more intense competition with every other one, both domestically and around the world, than we have seen perhaps ever before. I hesitated a little bit saying perhaps ever before, because our data and studies don't go back much before the early part of the 19th century in terms of what kind of competition companies felt themselves under, perhaps in the local or regional markets. But there's no question that since the 1970s, because of globalization and technological improvements, more and more actors, companies, entrepreneurs can get into almost any space. And so the old barriers to entry that used to be there, consisting primarily of economies of scale, you only had three or four major companies in every industry, like the auto industry with GM, Ford, and Chrysler, because you couldn't have more than three or four companies if they were going to depend on economies of scale, high volume, standardized mass production. But those days are over. They're over because globalization and technological change have allowed almost anybody to enter, even without large-scale economies.
Mm-hmm. So, but at the same time, I have in front of me a letter that's dated, let's see, March 14th from my son's principal. He's in sixth grade. It says, one of the best lessons I've ever learned in life is to reward the effort, not the result. And it seems to be this epidemic that's going on, whereas kids get, and I think even George Carlin just had a skit on this, that, you know, that people just get rewarded gratuitously for being there, for kind of breathing and being on the team rather than actually, you know, performing. So how do we account for the fact that we have this, you know, is it kind of going to end with this generation? The next generation is going to be a bunch of couch potatoes, you know, that wish hoping for trophies, or is this going to continue on for a long time?
No, I think just the opposite. I think that most people in the workforce today are working harder than their counterparts worked 20 or 30 or 40 years ago. I mean, we're seeing a workforce today in most families consisting of two wage earners. 30, 40 years ago, it was one wage earner. Most people today in the workforce are working longer hours. In fact, the average American is putting in something in the order, and I don't have the data right in front of me, about 300 or 400 hours a year more than the average European, more than the even industrious Japanese. We're also seeing that people are working under conditions where they have two or three jobs, perhaps part-time. We haven't seen this degree of intense workaholism on the part of any people in modern civilization, certainly not an advanced post-industrial country.
Well, what's the reason? Is it because of the always on? Is it because we have to, because things cost so much? Because the fact of the matter is, we're doing it just to succeed, and the eventual success is the kind of the brass ring. There's no time to relish the success.
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, part of it is related to what I said a moment ago about the changing structure of the American economy. 30, 40 years ago, when you had three or four major players in every industry, they roughly coordinated their production and their prices and their investments so that competition wasn't very intense. That meant that jobs were more secure. Many of these large companies resembled civil service bureaucracies. You worked your way up through the company over your lifetime. You stayed with the company for 40 years. Maybe you retired with a golden watch. You had a pension plan. It was a defined benefit plan, meaning you got a certain amount every month. Mm-hmm. You had a health plan. Well, those days are over. Every company is so intensely competitive with every other. They're trying to reduce costs, deliver better products. Now the entry barrier is not, in most cases, economies of scale. It's improvements, mm-hmm. New efficiencies, new products and processes and services that are faster, cheaper, and better. This puts everybody in the company under enormous strain and stress because not only do you as an employee have to keep up, but if you don't, you're going to be out of a job.
Mm-hmm.
You can't adjust the level of your work very often. It's either you're billing clients, and billable hours are something that people now have to contend with in professional life, such as they never contended with before. If you don't put in enough billable hours, you may find yourself either without a job or substantially demoted. Or even if you're a factory worker or a service worker, a production worker, you've got to put in overtime, and a lot of your salary is dependent on the number of hours worked, the amount of overtime. There's no cruise control any longer in mm-hmm. this economy.
Right. Well, I mean, and then on the other hand, you read, and it's again a little bit outside of discussion, or maybe it isn't. Last week, I was reading an article. I want to say it was Wall Street Journal, but maybe it was Investor's Business Daily about the milk company in India. There's no longer the need for the men to deliver the milk anymore. I don't know if you saw this piece. And they're still going to work every single day. They don't work. As a matter of fact, they have to go to work because if they leave work, they won't get paid. But as long as they show up, the milkman, as long as they show up to the job, sit around, play cards, read, and play games all day, they'll get paid. But, you know, it's essentially it's been, turned back to the government, and it's a job there. I mean, really, what we've done here is, when you say, I guess, super capitalism, really, it's the point of just, you know, so much stress on the company and the government just, I guess, not helping, which is that, you know, that republicanism, if you will. And, I guess that's what the problem has been, and the competitive nature of you know, our country and the fact that for a long time, I think that we were plain lazy and just expecting that we were the best.
Well, I don't know whether in the 1950s and 60s, let's call it the old economy, not that old. I remember the economy of the 50s and 60s.
That's what it was, black and white.
It was a simpler economy. People did not work as hard. The products and services did not change very much. I remember my father buying a Plymouth every 5 years or 6 years. It was essentially the same under the hood every 5 or 6 years. He bought a new Plymouth because he felt he just needed to make sure that it would not go completely bust on him. Mm-hmm. He didn't expect very much from it.
Right.
If you wanted a telephone, you had to deal with Ma Bell. Mm. There was no competition.
Mm-hmm.
If you wanted to put your savings somewhere, you didn't have Fidelity or Merrill Lynch or all of the different kinds of money market funds. No, you basically had a bank, the local bank, like Jimmy Stewart in It's a Wonderful Life. And I'm not saying that was a bad time, and I'm not saying it was a good time. It was just a very different time. We as consumers and investors didn't do all that well, didn't have many choices. But we as workers and as citizens had a chance to relax a little bit.
Right.
That's not the case. It's just been flipped in the other direction. We now, as investors, to the extent that we are investors, and notwithstanding what's been happening on Wall Street over the last year, but generally speaking, we as investors have been doing pretty good, pretty well, and we as consumers have been doing pretty well as well. Also, given the number of innovations, given that you look at the real prices of, say, a television set. In inflation-adjusted terms, televisions have been getting cheaper and cheaper. The same thing with any kind of stereo equipment, same with vacuum cleaners, appliances. I mean, everything is getting, in real terms, adjusted for inflation, cheaper, except stuff that cannot be boiled down to the normal competitive market, and that is medical costs, food, oil prices. None of those are subjected to the normal increasingly competitive market.
Now, not to be a conspiracy seeker here, but kind of interesting that it's the things that we need to our basic living requirements, right? I mean, oil aside, obviously we need to travel for business, but put that aside for a second. The other components, the medical and the health related costs, the food. I mean, I used to say, hey, 10 years ago, the price of bread isn't the same as it is today. I mean, it's kind of like the price of bread isn't the same today as it was yesterday anymore. And, I guess a lot of that has to do with the overconsumption, right? And, you talk about super capitalism. Maybe the next title is super consumption. You know, the fact is, I remember that game Pac-Man? Remember Pac-Man?
Yeah.
I see China as this giant Pac-Man just kind of eating through the Earth's mantle, everything in its way. Yeah. It's just consuming. But where does that leave us? Seriously, what's going on? I mean, yeah, there's some speculative nature of the pricing of corn and soybean and all that. But, I mean, seriously, where are we going here?
Well, here's the problem. And it's not really a problem from the standpoint of China and India, because, after all, their emerging middle classes want everything that Europeans and Americans and the middle classes of America and Europe have had. But it's a problem from the standpoint of global resources, because if a billion Chinese and a billion Indians join the ranks of 300 million Europeans and 300 million Americans, using up that amount of energy, that amount of food, that amount of all the other components that go into a middle-class lifestyle, then the planet will be destroyed. There's no way we can possibly live unless we all, in advanced countries now, and I'm talking about Europe and the United States and also Japan, agree that we are going to tighten our belts a little bit, or perhaps not enjoy quite the increase in living standards that we've become accustomed to.
Uh-huh.
And at the same time, we invest in new technologies that will hopefully allow us to make the environment cleaner, avoid global warming, generate even more productivity from the soil in terms of food. There are things that can be done. 50 years ago, 100 years ago, nobody would have expected that there could be 6 billion people on the globe,
mm-hmm.
And that so many of them could be living so well.
But, you know, at the same time, we talk about doing the right thing, right? That's what we're talking about, doing the right thing, saving the planet, all these wonderful things. But let's just look at what just happened the last 6 months. You know, talk about greed. I mean, you're telling me that what we have to do is tighten our belts, do the right thing, maybe not live so high on the hog. But meanwhile, you know, just a few months ago, just 6 months ago, a year ago, we have a Wall Street phenomena, which is a greed-infested banking and financial industry that has really done a tremendous number that we're seeing daily. Again, issues coming today. Wachovia came out with a real doozy, and who knows what's coming the rest of this week. I mean, we have a Fed that put, what are we up to, $400 billion of handouts at this point, and quite, you know, where are we going from here? I mean, I don't understand how this all balances. I don't understand what's going to, you know, and then the follow-up question is, what's next? Where are we, what's the next thing that's going to happen that's going to be disastrous in this current environment?
Well, you know, you're right in talking about finance. I mean, what's happened is that over the same course of 50 years, comparing the old economy to the new, finance has gone from being the handmaiden of industry. The financial markets would help arrange mergers or acquisitions or new issues of stock, to being basically industry, the plaything of Wall Street and, mm-hmm. and the plaything of finance. Finance is where all the big money is, where mm-hmm. all the big deals are, where a lot of the entrepreneurship is. Finance has become the kind of leading indicator of the economy. And it's the least controlled in the sense that we don't know what's going on there. Even the heads of big Wall Street banks don't know. And yet at the same time, ironically, we citizens are bailing out Wall Street to the tune, as you said, of hundreds of billions of dollars. The Fed has become a fourth branch of government, more powerful than the other three. We don't even, you know, the Fed can appropriate, in effect, appropriate hundreds of billions of taxpayer dollars without a hearing, without a authorization hearing, an appropriation hearing, without anybody knowing anything about it. The Fed can bring one bank down and arrange a merger or an acquisition with another bank and put up federal taxpayers' money to do that. The Fed can, and it does it now, it's doing it right now as we speak, reduce interest rates and thereby accomplish some things, but at the same time create some dangers, such as a falling dollar that makes oil and food even more expensive for our people. Mm-hmm. Can you imagine Congress arranging things so that oil prices and food prices would be heading upward? Well, there has to be some way, it seems to me, of maybe not politicizing the Fed. I'd hate for the Fed to be subject to partisan politics, but at the same time, making it more accountable, giving people more idea about what the Fed is actually doing, why it's doing it, and what we can expect from financial markets.
Well, you know, it's interesting because it was, I don't know if you know my friend Barry Ritholtz, he had a piece on his blog today or yesterday about Volcker saying, you know, Volcker is not at all happy with Bernanke, and, you know, the big question actually, I was talking to Barry earlier, and he said that he wanted to ask, you know, if Obama comes in to the presidential seat, who do you believe he would replace, or if he would replace Bernanke with someone? You have an answer to that?
I don't think a new president will replace Bernanke. You don't want to replace Fed chairs unless you have to. By the way, the Fed chair is appointed for 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
So Bernanke came last year, so he would still have another couple of years mm-hmm. to go
right.
With a new president, in any event.
Right.
But you don't want to undermine the confidence of financial markets by changing the chairman of the Federal Reserve Board unless there is broad consensus that the chair has done a bad job. Bernanke, I think, has done a fairly good job. His predecessor, Alan Greenspan, got us into this mess.
Well,
Greenspan, you know, it was Greenspan's reducing, cutting interest rates down to 1% federal funds rate in 2003, and then basically poo-pooing any effort to have any federal oversight
mm-hmm.
At all of what was going on. You can't make money that cheap and at the same time expect there won't be every lender in the world trying to get money out of the door into the hands of any potential borrower who can
right.
simply stand up straight.
Right.
And you have to have oversight, at least in the United States, and to the extent that you can do that around the world. But that's something Greenspan just didn't care about.
Right. So, I mean, I've always asked the question, if you could borrow money at zero cost, how much do you borrow? I mean, all of it, right?
Of course. That's what happened. I mean, the money was so cheap that it went out to anybody. It created a housing bubble. We are living with the results of that housing bubble bursting. The results are also found not only in, you know, in the decline of the most important assets people have, the middle class, their houses or their nest eggs, but also their pension plans. We're seeing pension plans that are going substantially downhill because of the crisis on Wall Street, and then credit markets are completely blocked, and largely because nobody knows how much bad debt anybody else is holding. Which is going to make this recession possibly much worse than otherwise.
You know, a couple of points I want to mention. Harry Dent, who has been on my show many times and love his work, pretty radical in terms of some of his theories. You know, talks about 2009 being the next great depression, and it's based on demographic economics where you look at, you know, the average person's age and how much they spend, et cetera, et cetera. You had written a couple of pieces on your blog, great blog, by the way, and I'll put the links on the show notes. That are, you know, and asked the question, and then wrote about, you know, are we headed to a depression? You know, are we? I mean, where?
Well,
first
of all, there's no consensus about what a depression means. Unlike a recession, which is two back-to-back quarters of negative growth, where the economy contracts, a depression. All we know, and all we know in kind of common parlance, is that depression is something very bad, and it is probably a very severe and long recession.
Mm-hmm.
Is that likely to come about? I place the probability around 20%, creeping up there. I mean, maybe it's a little higher than 20%. Not very high, but not very comfortable, even at that rate.
Right.
I mean, the next recession, the consensus that I have heard among Wall Street types is that the recession will end, that we are in one, but it will end the second half of this year as all of those economic stimulus checks go out. I think that's baloney.
Oh, that's crap.
Frankly,
I mean, those aren't going to do anything.
I think that these are cheerleaders. I think a lot of people on Wall Street just want to be cheerleaders. That's what their natural inclination is. They'd like to have a rally. The reality is much worse. All the indicators I see suggest that the second half of this year is going to be terrible.
Yeah.
And it could be. I don't know that we're going to have, it'll continue into 2009, but I expect it will. I think there's a better than 50-50 chance of the recession continuing at least through the first half of 2009.
Well, let me, I agree completely, by the way. I think that, you know, these people that are the cheerleaders, they're not only cheerleaders, they're hopefuls because they need to keep their jobs. That's what's going on. I mean, that's what I think is happening, but that's a different discussion. I have a very serious question, and that is this. I am, you know, I do not understand the fundamental issue that's going on right now in these markets. We are seeing write-offs in unprecedented numbers. I mean, the numbers are just astounding that, you know, in the old days, somewhere between the 50s and the 90s, okay, you know, the word write-offs was a bad thing, right? I mean, you don't just write off. Write-off is bad. It's kind of, you know, chopping my arm off. You don't take that lightly. We seem to be very desensitized to this whole area of, you know, the issue of write-offs. You know, I've been on the bandwagon against Capital One. You know, I've been really very upset about their off-balance sheet financing, about $50 billion, and the fact that this came in this month, a couple of days ago, with the $500 million monthly write-off, you know, a little bit quietly on their 8K. I don't understand how we're allowing this to happen and why, when we see these write-offs, that we see rallies. What's going on?
I think the rally is simply because investors, mostly institutional investors, are breathing a sigh of relief that they feel that they know how bad things are. They feel like we're reaching bottom. You know, when you see a big write-off, what goes off in a lot of professionals' heads is we're at the bottom, and now we've seen the worst of it, and now we can get that behind us. I think that's wishful thinking, frankly. I think that a write-off means, frankly, your profits are way down. Your price earnings ratios are much worse. Your outlook may be even worse in the future. Mm-hmm. But that's not the way the street is interpreting all of this stuff.
Well, how about this? The fact is that if, in fact, conventional wisdom says, and the street says, that write-offs are a sign of a bottom, right? So we know that. Don't you think that it is potential that we see the, you know, we see these PR spinners saying, hey, I have an idea. You know, let's do this. Let's increase our dividend. Looks good. Let's do a little share buyback. Looks good. And you know what? We'll do a write-off because everybody knows when you do a write-off, it's kind of, you know, indication of bottom. This way, at least we can keep this thing going for a little while longer. Who knows why? 100 different reasons why. Maybe we'll wait it out. We'll feel better at the end. I mean, it's a PR spin, a lot of this.
Yes, I agree with that. I think a lot of it's PR. I think the institutional investor community has been sold a bill of goods, and I think they're selling us a bill of goods.
Mm-hmm.
Because behind the institutional investors are who? Us.
Yep.
You know, normal people trying to maintain a pension plan or maintain, you know, some sort of fund, and we are being told
mm-hmm.
that we're reaching bottom, which gets us back to the point I made just a moment ago, that the recession is likely to be much worse than we are actually knowing or seeing.
Mm.
Housing prices have fallen maybe 10-12% around the country. It's going to be another 12-15% to get houses and housing prices back to the normal ratio with regard to rents and incomes. So if that happens, and so much of these bad loans are wrapped up in securities and nobody has any idea where they are, then how in the world are we going to even think we've seen the end of this?
Yeah, I don't know. I know you have to run. I just have one more question about I have so many questions to ask you, and I appreciate your time. What is the reason, the rationale, the how do we allow for, you know, to get into this hole again? And what I mean by that is, there's no difference here. I've been doing this 25 years, and this is a replay, a little bit of a different replay and a different, you know, kind of a different scope. But, you know, we were absolutely not going to allow the over-leveraging. You know, back in the long-term capital days, Meriwether ran this fund, and it blew up on them. And meanwhile, they gave him another few billion dollars to blow up again.
Oh, and then go back a few decades before that, and then a few decades before that. Go back to the Great Depression.
It's unbelievable.
I mean, after the great crash of 1929, we say, we're going to control the leveraging. And what happens is, you know, the masterminds of leveraging are finding, you know, it's like a leaky boat. They find every single place, every way they can leverage. And as long as we are in a system that hates regulation
mm-hmm.
and doesn't want to look over the shoulders of anybody and believes that there should be tax breaks attached to debt that are not there with regard to anything else, then there is going to be a huge systemic preference for over-leveraging. If you can use other people's monies and make big bets with other people's money, then sure, why not do so?
And then get bailed out.
And if you can get bailed out, even better. But even if you didn't get bailed out, so what? You get all the upside gains. The worst that can happen is you go bust. But it's not you going bust. It's they. It's the other people's money that you're dealing with. I mean, you just go on to the next project. You know, the bankruptcy law is very, very good at protecting now people who have risk-generated businesses. Bankruptcy law is terrible if you're an average person who has to refinance their debt. I mean, forget it.
Mm-hmm. Right. All right, last question, unions. I wrote a piece not too long ago, just a little piece about the American Axle issue, and there was a whole discussion about $70 per union employee was being paid, you know, a total package price, of course, between pension and health insurance and all overtime and all these different things. What's your take on unions and how they've either corrupted or changed over the last number of years, and how they've cost America or not? I'm not a big fan of unions. Let's just put on the table. Not all unions, but many, and I think they've changed over the years. I mean, where do you think the place for unions are in America moving forward?
Well, remember, unions are a very small portion of the American workforce, and the private sector, fewer than 8% of American workers belong to a union. That's down from 1955, where we had 35%. You know, you have 35% of your workers in unions. That sets prevailing wages in your economy. Fewer than 8%, you're talking about little tiny sectors. I mean, it's almost not even a subject any longer. Certainly, it's you don't have labor union reporters, you don't have labor beats, you don't have the subject of labor economics being taught. It's a little footnote. But in the local service economy, retail, restaurant, hotel, hospital, surface transportation, child care, elder care, in all of these local services, where what you're giving is attention. These local service economies where you're not competing globally, you're not competing with low-wage workers abroad, you're not competing with machinery, you're not competing with software that can do the job easier, you're basically dealing with labor-intensive work at the local level. That's where we are seeing the rebirth of unionization. They, you know, go to places at the local service economy level now, and you see SEIU, HERE, all of these unions that that are representing very low-wage workers, I mean, we're talking about the lowest of the low-wage workers, they are now beginning to expand, beginning to flex their muscles. They're organizing like mad. That is the future of unionization. Now, I wish I could stay with you. I've got to go teach a class.
I have 300
undergraduates waiting for me.
Well, teach them the good stuff. Thank you so much, Robert Reich, Supercapitalism, the Transformation of Business, Democracy, and Everyday Life. Thanks a lot.
Take care.
Bye-bye. The Zach Zone is sponsored by Newsflasher.com, a new way to view headline news from all the major news sources. Get a wide-angle view of all the hot topics making news by viewing just a single page. Newsflasher, it's as quick as a flash. Type the word newsflash, then the letter R, .com, and see for yourself. The Zach Zone with Zachary Scheidt. Zach is a portfolio manager at Stearman Capital and blogs at ZachStocks.com.
Well, hey, Andrew, the IPO roadshows where the underwriters showcase the deals that are coming up have been moving along pretty well. And we now have three deals on the calendar for next week, the week of the 27th. The first one is the Intrepid Potash, which is actually a fertilizer company. These guys have been in the news, the whole industry has actually, as commodities are booming and agriculture is in demand, and farmers are having a hard time getting a hold of supplies. So these guys should have plenty of demand for their stock, and it should be an interesting deal. The second one is American Water Works, and as we know, the utilities have been a hot issue as well. Drinking water is becoming more and more scarce. Here in Atlanta, we've had a huge drought, and it's been a big issue from the social side to the political side to the economic side. So American Water Works should be one that'll be interesting. And then Digital Domain. This one I'm not quite as excited about, but they'll probably price it right. It'll probably trade okay. It's a technology company that's not quite profitable yet, and we'll see what happens. But in addition to purchasing good IPOs and holding on to them, I also enjoy working on the short side, especially in a market like we saw Friday, where we have significant weakness. And so in times like this, when you've got a lot of ups and downs, you want to have a more balanced portfolio, and you want to be looking for stocks that are going to decline and see if you can profit from shorting these stocks. The one that I'm looking at right now is Chipotle Mexican Grill, or CMG. This is a spinoff from McDonald's from early 2006. They priced the stock at 22. It was a really tough one to get a hold of, and I got actually no shares on the deal and was hopping mad. But at any rate, we got involved in it. It traded from 22 all the way up to 155 this past January, so it's been a great winner. But at the same time, I think it's time to turn around and hit left-handed and short this thing and make some money on the way back down. The reason why is that there are basically three issues facing the company that are going to cause some lack of profitability. You know, they're actually going to make money, but they're going to make less, I think, than people expect, and it's sporting a pretty good multiple. So here's the three issues that we got to deal with. The first is rising commodity costs. As farmers are turning more of their production to ethanol and biofuels and so forth, the cost of grain and wheat and even meat and chicken are going up because they use grain and wheat to raise their poultry and their beef. And so these higher commodity costs are basically increasing the cost of goods sold for Chipotle. At the same time, we have a weakening consumer. You've been talking a lot about the issues at Capital One Financial as consumers have high debt levels. Well, this is going to play out in the consumer sector, and we've also seen unemployment reports show a higher level of unemployment, and people are seeking jobs, and you know, it's just a weakening time. So if you've got higher prices for these restaurants, and you've got a weakening consumer who's unable to you know, spend on discretionary items like going out to eat, it could be a difficult time for such a company. And the third issue, as we mentioned, was that this has a pretty high multiple. The stock trades more than 40 times 2008 earnings, which compares to its peers that are trading in the high teens. So even if Chipotle came down to a multiple of 30 or so, it would still move the stock price to 80, or it could possibly trade below that, but I think that 80 is a reasonable multiple, or a reasonable price, which is more than a 25% decline from this point. So I think that this is one that you have to look at from the short side. When you're shorting, time is really of the essence. If you get the timing wrong, it's really the same as being wrong in general. So we need to look for an opportune time to get involved in names like this. And right now the chart is showing footprints of pretty good institutional selling. So I think that if you look at this name right now, this week, you're seeing a breakdown, and the overall market may be giving up the fight, at least temporarily. And so it seems like an opportune time to short Chipotle. To look at this name and other names in the new issue area, please give me a visit. It's zachstocks.com, Z-A-C-H, stocks.com. And I look forward to talking to you next week. Thanks, Andrew.
Hey, thanks so much, Zach. Another great report. Zach Stocks, a great way to get some information on the leading and best and potentially best IPOs and primary markets, as well as some good ideas on some stocks overall. Thanks a lot, Zach, and for all your hard work. All right, that's all we have for today on the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Thanks a lot for joining me. And, you know, I really appreciate all the support. Visit thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Visit AOL's Blogging Stocks. They're showing some of my work as well now. And do me a favor, write me any questions you have at askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. And do me a favor, check out Capital One. We'll see if anything worthwhile, or maybe just, again, a hunk of junk, something is very strange and I've seen is totally cockeyed, which it is possible. It seems like their earnings are going to be rather concerning on April 17th. That doesn't mean the stock is going to go down entirely, but I think their earnings are going to be really quite awful, and they're going to be, really with a concerning outlook. Again, make sure to subscribe, leave a iTunes message for me, and leave a review. And of course, if you can, leave a review on Amazon. I really appreciate it. Go buy the book and have a great week. Cuddle up in a bed, maybe take the Disciplined Investor with you and check it out. I really appreciate it and all your support. I'll see you real soon. Thank you so much for joining me. Andrew Horowitz, over and out.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contain forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations, and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor regulated by the SEC. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.